This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps. Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're covering education, how that can be a factor in mental health, and how including mental health education on the curriculum may benefit so many lives. So we'll start off with a few stats. First off, 1 in 10 children aged between 5 and 16 years, that works out roughly 3 in every classroom, has a mental health problem, and many continue to have these problems into adulthood. So that one in particular is important to highlight how early mental illness can start and how early children therefore need to have an understanding of what mental health is and how they can be a part of maintaining it. Also, over half of all mental ill health starts before the age of 14 years, and 75% has developed by the age of 18. Among teenagers in particular, rates of depression and anxiety have increased by 70% in the last 25 years. NHS England estimates that poor mental health costs the economy, the NHS and society £105 billion a year in England. So there are some really key stats we've got from Place to Be. It's hinted there at how it's kind of increased over the last 25 years as well.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts, Annie?
That really strikes me. The 3 in every classroom thing really strikes me. I mean, I work with children really regularly and also in mainstream schools. And there's 30 children to a classroom. I actually worked in a private school today where there was like 7 kids in a class. And that's insanely, like, rare. Like, often classes are 30, even 31 sometimes, which they're not technically supposed to do, but they just have no choice but to take on that extra kid. And that just really strikes me because I have so many times in my day or my working week where I see that sea of 30 little faces looking at me. I think just three out of those kids, 3 of them, which seems like a really small number, but when you're looking like a sea of kids' faces, kind of like, yeah, we want to learn, we want to have fun, and we want to learn from you, and you're this cool drama lady that's turned up to like come and do some fun workshop with us about, I don't know, God knows what, whatever I talk about in my working day. But like, it just really gets me, like really, really gets me really hard. And if you think about it, you know, in mainstream schools, often they've got maybe 2 classes per year group. So that's 6 years plus reception. That's 7, so potentially 14 classrooms in a sort of standard mainstream school, and I don't know what that maths is. 42 children in one school will have a mental health problem. That was really quick maths for me. I've never done maths that quick before. I don't like that. That's sad.
Yeah, it's madness, and I get what you mean. It's something where you see it, and because it's not talked about, you don't know who those 3 are.
Why aren't we doing this more? Why aren't we doing this more? It makes me so mad.
Well, that's the thing. I think we mentioned that in the episode. To us, it's really obvious how big a part education plays in mental health.
I wonder, like, when you said the thing about how much poor mental health costs the UK economy every year. You know, you get, someone who's, you know, now technically, I suppose, an activist and a campaigner, we often come into contact with a lot of people naturally and, you know, fairly easily. We come into a lot of contact with a lot of people who are very liberal minded, very left leaning. And you'd think that stats about losing money would sort of attract the right wing. You know, it's like, oh no, we're losing all this precious money, we must protect it. But it's still not happening. So I'm really wondering what the issue is. Is that people think that mental health is a sign of weakness? You know, admitting to it that it's a problem means that there's a sign of weakness. I mean, we're not in the war anymore, people. Like, it was that stiff upper lip thing, I think, that's just really carried over. And I just think, why? What use has it served in 2018? It makes me so cross. I'm probably not saying things, you know, as diplomatically or as sensitively or tactfully as I could, but it just makes me so mad, you know? I'm so glad that we're doing this.
I get it, and it's one of those things that, it's sad to say this, but part of the reason I really wanted to include that statistic, and that's also included on our petition as well, is to appeal to people that don't understand. That have no idea of mental illness, are very much on board with the stigma, don't get it, but hopefully they can at the very least see how costing the economy money is.
Yeah, well, you'd hope that would be enough.
To put it in context for anyone, because, you know, we can easily throw about big numbers,
the overall NHS budget in the years, so the tax year 2015 to 2016, was 116.4 billion. So the fact that that's the stat I gave previously of it costing 105 billion a year just in England gives you an idea of actually if we can support people with their mental health from a younger age. All these concerns about funding the NHS, well, there's plenty of money being lost through lack of provision there that we could potentially put into it.
But at the same time, I'm just so proud that we are now part of a collection of people that have actually taken action, and we've used the resources that we have, and we've used the intel that we have personally to make better change. I think that's really the crux of this, is we can sit here and whinge and talk. Well, I mean, I say whinge is probably not the best word, because I mean, it's good to talk about these things. It's good to get them out in the open, but as long as it's followed up by action, I think. Do you know what I'm saying? Like,
absolutely.
Yeah. And I'm just really proud that we've done that. This is why I'm so thrilled about this episode, because it's just so nice to kind of recap on how this petition's gone. And looking back on it, just thinking,
well, it's nice to get the chance to talk about the progress and take a moment to check in and and be proud of that. So, because it's, you know, it's a very different thing talking on the show than writing an update on the petition. So our guest this week is Emma Burdett. She runs a theatre company that tours around primary and secondary schools teaching about mental health and various other factors like confidence, body image, all the things that can go into keeping a healthy mind. So she's someone that's got lived experience of seeing the change this can create in schools, and she's such a delightful person. I can't wait to maybe even have her on the podcast
again. I'd love that. Yeah, I'd really, really love that. I think the thing that I love about her so much is that she's identified this enormous gap and she's filling it. And she really is, you know, she's doing amazing work. I'm so glad we've had her.
Yeah, absolutely. And so we'll get into that episode in a moment. But first,
this week's Audible recommendation.
I'm recommending Mad Girl by Bryony Gordon. Bryony talks about mental health in a totally relatable way through honesty and humour. You can try your first book with Audible for free with our link, bit.ly/mentalbooks, and the details are in the description for this episode.
Okay, so I'm Emma Burdett, and I'm the founder of Real Talk Theatre Company. My first experience with really recognising my mental health was going downhill was when I was in primary school and I'd been selected to be the main character in a school play. And everyone was like really excited. So I think I was about 8 years old, and I just didn't feel any happiness. And I just thought I knew something was wrong, really. I mean, I was very young, but I just remember thinking to myself, oh yeah, okay, but no happiness. And it was more about, my dad was, he was my teacher in year four. So I was very much known for being my father's daughter. So I had so much pressure, I felt, on me to make my family name proud. And I think that got on top of me more than what I actually wanted to do. And so then when I went off to secondary school, I was a bit rebellious. And that was when, I think looking back, because it's easier now to look back, I realised that I suffered from really low self-esteem. So my friendship groups, I would be very much, I used the word pushover. If they wanted me to do anything, I'd do it because I wanted to have people around me. And yeah, and then that progressed onto relationships as well. So I was in quite abusive relationships, not physically. And at the time, because that wasn't really discussed at schools as well, but really emotional, I'd be put down quite a bit, again, by my friends and by my boyfriend at the time, but I wouldn't see it as bad. I'd think, oh, I've got a boyfriend, that's fine. and yeah, and that just progressed a bit to, I went to university and I studied drama, so I got a degree, so I was ticking all of these boxes.
I just want to pause there on the subject of ticking boxes, because that seems to be something that comes up time and time again, is this conditioning we experience of, you have a partner and that makes you happy, and therefore we can prioritise, ironically, the partner above our happiness. Because, oh, but they make us happy, so they've got to stay.
Yes, that's so true. And there's such a pressure on that. And I think for myself in the past and for lots of people who I know now, they stay in relationships, not because they're happy, but literally because it ticks a box. Because it's almost when people say, oh, well, it's, I think by how people judge success isn't on happiness. It's, do they tick the box? Do they have a successful job? Do they live in a nice big house? What's their career?
Yes.
And that's actually quite easy, really, if you want to throw yourself into that. I think it's much more difficult to be true to yourself and be happy and, yeah, sort of discover real self-worth and do what your life is really meant for, so your purpose. I think that's really quite difficult. And I think that really is what I feel should have been for me anyway, taught in schools about what makes you as an individual happy, what makes you as an individual full stop, really. But because it was very much stress on math, science, English, I'm 30 now, just turned, and we had to get the 5 A to C's to go on to progress to A levels. And yeah, it was all very much academic success. And so it is very much that word success was not ever associated with happiness. It's associated with academics and academia.
For sure. But let the record show, because I like stats. Actually, when I went to school, most people weren't getting the 5 A to C's. It was actually more than 50% weren't. And that was something that I was never told. There was all that focus on that. And yet you were denied the reality of it.
And then what does it do to all of those other people? Because then they're deemed a failure. And how's that going to make them feel?
Yeah, whereas in comparison, because I knew that, I felt great. Because I was like, well, I have dyslexia and I've got more than my 5 A to C's. I'm doing better than half the country. I'll just coast now. Yeah. I'm doing fine.
Completely. Yeah, and I think there's a lot of pressure on that. And then it is sort of, oh, okay, we'll go back to ticking the box. I've ticked that box. I've got those 5 A to C's. Now my future, you know, I'm on that right path.
Mm-hmm.
At school, for me at that point in time, it was very made that you have to go in that direction and the other direction isn't an option. So it wasn't even spoken about.
For sure. Yeah, we've got a whole episode on student mental health. Brilliant. Which is a lot about that.
Brilliant.
And so coming back to your experience, then you progressed on to university.
Yes, I did. And it was just when I was doing the freshers week, so the first couple of weeks at university, I was in a relationship because I'd taken a gap year and I'd meant to travel, but I was always and still am awful with money. So I ended up working in a shop just for that year. And I ended up dating the deputy manager. He's a fair bit older than me, but he was, looking back, he was very abusive, like emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
And he had then, just a couple of months into the relationship, started saying, oh, I've just found out I was with someone just before meeting you and she's pregnant. So I need you to quit university because I need you to get a job and so that we can provide for this unborn child. And now, if anyone was to say that to me now, I would tell them to go away.
You are allowed to say.
I tell them to go fuck themselves, yeah. But at that time, I think I just really didn't realise my worth. And I was like, okay, yeah, I'll do that then. And I was really contemplating quitting university to then go, and he wanted me to get a job. He thought he wanted me in something, in his words, better than a shop, because he needed me to earn more money. So I was going to become an estate agent because apparently that was commission-based, the one that he had lined up. And I was going to quit. And it was just one evening. I went for a drive and there was just something that told me, hang on, what am I doing?
Mm.
And so then I said to him, no, I'm not happy with quitting university. He really wasn't happy. He used a lot of sort of guilt trips and things like that. So we should have broken up then, but we didn't. That it dragged out for a good 2 or 3 more months. And then it was just a good friend just told me, look, you need to just cut this man off. But I think it's that hindsight thing. You can see, of course, that was so unhealthy. But back then.
And at the time, you were putting a lot of your self-worth in him. So if he told you this is what you need to do, you'd believe it.
Yes. And it was the whole validation thing. And it was, I think he was making up for something that I was lacking. And yeah, he would just tell me the right things. And it was almost he was feeding me what I needed, even though there was also a lot of toxic energy, just everything was bad, really. But I didn't realise it at the time, just because, I just didn't see my worth in that. And so I did get out of that relationship. It took me a long time to really start building on my worth. I realised that it translates into jobs as well. Mm-hmm. So being an actor, it's not like you just go from, you know, you don't just build on top of the CV and end up a millionaire or whatever. So I found that what would happen would be that I'd get a good acting job and then they'd want to keep me on, but then they'd just make me be, for example, a tour manager or something, which they'd give me more and more responsibility. But I didn't have the confidence in myself to go and create my own company, even though I was very good at what I was doing. And so right from, I think, year two of being a professional actor, I started thinking I'd really love to create my own theatre company and I want to do something about mental health, because mm-hmm. I've been doing a lot of work on myself to build my confidence, my self-esteem.
And so at that point, how was your mental health?
It was up and down, but I put it down to the career of acting, because people okay. then would always say, oh, but with acting, you know, it's you've got a job and then you've got nothing. So you're earning money and then nothing at all. So I put it all on the career, even though now when I look back, you can see it was obviously not in a good place. But I think maybe I was scared, maybe because of the stigma attached to it. It was like, oh, no, it won't be anything like that. It's because I've gone into this profession.
It's so common that you externalise it. Did you get a diagnosis or any kind of support, or was that much later?
I did. It was a good few years later. It was actually after a breakup with a very decent guy, actually. It was more, I think, me being just very difficult to be around. I think I just started, what's the word, self-sabotage. I had a lot of that going on, and I think I pushed him away because he was a good guy. He's now a good friend, actually. But at the time, yeah, I was just not in a good place. And then I felt really low and I thought, this is not good. Mm-hmm. I started having suicidal thoughts and everything. So I thought, OK, I need to do something. So then I made a doctor's appointment. And then that was when they put me on antidepressants. They didn't offer therapy or anything like that. It did at that time. And this is going back about 8 years now. They pretty much said, oh, I'll write you this out. There you are. And I was on antidepressants then for about, not long, about 7 months. And then I gradually came off them. I was acting abroad in Italy and I gradually, very, very slowly came off them. And I just felt at that time I had a good support network and it was a good place. And so I came off them. However, then it was, go back, now this is more recently, 2 years ago, then I started feeling really low again. And I thought, this is not good. And I started having anxiety attacks as well. And I didn't really want to go back on antidepressants, just because I think for me, there was still, the stigma was attached. I was sort of proud in a way that, oh, I was on antidepressants, but now I'm off them. Mm. Even though, of course, if you need them, you should, you know, they shouldn't
be
shame.
Well, that's the thing, that actually the real progress is your mental health getting better, not you not having support.
Exactly. Yeah. I think it was just how I was feeling. Oh, yes, I'm triumphant. I came off them. But it was just sort of a warped way mm-hmm. of thinking. And yeah, so I was put on them. Yeah, this was over 2 years ago and I stayed on them for 2 years. And then I asked for therapy as well. I was like, I'd like some talking therapy. I'd like CBT. So I thought there's a lot that I need to just deal with. And I managed to get counselling, and that was through IAPT.
Yes.
And yeah, and I found that actually really useful, like really, really helpful. The only real problem I had was right at the end. It was obvious they were stretched. Because you could see as soon as you're called in, she'd sort of have the notes of the person before out still. She's trying to quickly get them away. And on my last appointment, she said, oh, OK, so we've got one more left after this. So I was thinking, oh, OK, great. But I had in my head, I think this is the last session. But this still, I think, showed my confidence wasn't completely back. Because though we were talking through, and of course, it's bringing up things. Mm. And then right at the end, I said, oh, OK, so I'll see you next week. And then she just checked the diary and she said, oh, no, Emma, I'm so sorry. I've messed up. This was your last session. I'm so sorry. I've got someone coming in. Goodbye, basically. Wow. And I just felt absolutely spat out. Because, of course, with it, you know, you're thinking, oh, OK, because I was on that waiting list for long enough anyway. But you're still thinking, OK, great, great, great. We're finally going through it. It does bring up things. So you are feeling a bit, OK, let's just try and deal with it. And I was really looking forward to the last session being like a plan of action or just something.
And I don't think it was her fault. I think it's just because they're under so much stress.
Yeah, it definitely sounds a symptom of how stretched they were, but the way it was handled isn't ethical at all.
No.
Because it's like any kind of relationship, you should be entitled to closure.
That was it. And I was saying to my partner, he's very supportive, that was the word I used. I just said, I just wanted some sort of closure, and it felt like I had been spat out. And it did feel almost like I was in a worse place for a good few months after that. And then what I did, because I found myself quite resentful as well. And so I thought, well, the best way is for me to educate myself better. So that's where I started just reading a lot of books on it, and like with CBT and things like that. And I really threw myself into the theatre company. I thought, okay, I need to take this bad thing and try and turn it into something good. And I think that was the push I really needed to throw myself into, yeah, creating something based on the bad experiences I'd had.
For sure. And could you talk us through a little bit of what the theatre company is?
Yes. Okay, so it's called Real Talk Theatre Company. And what it does is it goes around to primary schools and secondary schools. And we do interactive workshops and performances. And so myself and the other actors, we're all certified mental health first aiders. So we can signpost, really. So if someone comes up and they're really struggling, we cannot, of course, we're not trained counsellors, but at least we have some form of knowledge and we know of the help that's out there, which I think is a lot of the time when children do say things to us, it's good to at least let them know they're not alone.
Yes.
And we do talks with parents as well, because what happened, it wasn't planned that we'd start doing talks with parents, but a lot of the times in the workshops or at the end of a performance, children would come and confide in us and they'd say, oh, yeah, but I can't say anything to my mum, or oh, but my uncle says this, or oh, but if we say this, it's weak. Or yeah, so we started learning quite a few things and a few trends that were coming up. So we do also offer that at the end of the day, we do a presentation to parents. And that has actually proved really quite insightful, I'd say. It's been difficult in some schools for a lot of parents to turn up. And then what we hear from the teachers are the people who do turn up don't really need to be there. They're very supportive parents in terms of that. And they're quite in tune. And the parents who aren't there are the ones who will just brush it off.
Mm.
So it's difficult to really be speaking to those parents. Especially we've had a lot, there's been a real rise in people talking to us about self-harm.
Yes.
And a lot of it we hear anyway is a lot down to they really feel they can't speak to their parents about it. And it just, if the parents could just make themselves more approachable, it's not that it would stop things, but I feel it's, you know, there's a lot in there that they just want to be able to express themselves and they're not feeling that they can. And I think a lot of it is because everyone's so stressed now and with money and situations like that. But yeah, it would be just so good to sort of, you want to like physically shake the parents and be like, just listen to your child, please just be there for them. I'm sure you love them, but the way you're showing them is meaning they don't feel that you're open to them.
Yeah, but also that's something that you're never going to be able to just fix in a day.
No.
And, you know, that leads into kind of the work we're trying to do in terms of campaigning for mental health education to be on the compulsory curriculum for all schools. Because at the moment, whilst you've highlighted some of the issues there that you're facing, those kids, I still believe, are greatly better off from having that experience, from having you come into the school. Because for most people, myself included, you never have any mental health mention in your whole school experience. So the fact that you even get one day is progress.
Yes, I'd really agree, especially when we were starting out and I funded it by myself. And so a lot of the times, and the schools were saying, look, we really don't have any money. So I did quite a few for free. And it's so rewarding as well when you can actually see the change that you're making.
Yeah.
And even to very young children, we do one for just years one. And we just say, if they can just grade how they're feeling, we just say, just take a moment, just think, how are you feeling today? With like being a real confident, really, really happy, being a 10, being quite a sort of timid, just feeling a little bit maybe upset, being zero. We say, you don't need to tell us why, just check in with yourself. And we've got a nice row across. We usually do it in a school hall, so they go and stand there. And then sometimes we ask, would their friends have put them there? And they say no. And why? Oh, because they're always really loud or they're really quiet. And it's just getting them to understand that everyone, even when you're so young, you're still playing a part. And just to check in with each other and be good friends. Because I think that's something,
it's just they may not have that at home. So let's create a good foundation from when they're young just to look after each other. And that seems to be working really well. The teachers have been very happy with just seeing that. So you can see results just from a simple exercise like that seems to help.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think that's so important to highlight how, you know, from any age, this, you know, this is something the kids are experiencing. Maybe they don't all have experiences of mental illness, but they, you know, they're all going through things. They're all going through a lot of changes in their lives. As they get older, they're going through a lot of hormonal and body changes. And as much as the conversation should still be had at home about mental health, it's something that the schools are the thing that we can regulate.
Mm-hmm.
We can't regulate what happens in someone's own home. So the fact that you're in the school telling them that it's okay to feel like that right from an early age set something in, because kids can be so impressionable. And no doubt you've had experiences where you meet the parents of the kids that don't feel they can talk to think about things at home, and you're like, ah, that makes sense. Yeah. That you're that
instantly
parent.
Yeah,
that's something that I particularly wanted to talk to you about. Has there been any negative effects that you've noticed when teaching in primary school?
No. And that's not me just trying to be biased because it's my own company. No, I wouldn't say that at all. I'd say sometimes you can see that there'll be maybe the classroom assistants or the teachers who it may just be their resting face, but it doesn't look overly enthusiastic.
Yes.
But from the children, not at all. They're very willing because they don't have any inhibitions as well at that age. So that is why I think it's the prime time to start talking about it. I mean, it's still great to be talking to teenagers now anyway, because as you say, they haven't actually ever heard anything about it, you know, if they're not speaking about it at home. But if you start when they're really young, then they will have, it's all they'll be able to remember is keeping their mental health and conversations about it. It's not going to be a taboo subject or anything.
Absolutely. And it's about that. If they can't remember a time where they weren't able to talk about that, that's surely the ideal. And actually, whilst it's great to have those conversations at home as well, in the research we've done, it shows time and time again that the kids bring those conversations home. So actually, it's less important whether the parents or the teachers or outside companies start it. It's the fact that the conversation starts.
Exactly.
And starts as early as possible. Because with the campaign we're running, we're getting some really brilliant progress in that the Department of Education is drawing up all kinds of reforms to a new equivalent to PSHE. They're planning to call it RHE, so Relationship and Health Education.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's taking a particular part of PSHE and expanding on it and reforming it. And it's been really positive to see, going through that consultation period ourselves and contributing to that, they are making provisions right from primary school.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of the stuff primary school is more to do with like what self-care is and how you can look after your well-being on the inside and the outside, and what is and isn't appropriate behaviour with other kids, and giving them an idea of what healthy relationships look like. You know, obviously at that age, it's mainly friends and parents as opposed to, you know, their relationships that come later on. But it's setting that foundation.
Completely.
And it's really positive to see that they've obviously gone away and done their research off the back of this campaign and seen the benefits of starting really young. So it's really positive to hear that you're not seeing any negative effects from starting really young.
No.
How does that differ with secondary school work that you do?
Yeah, so with the primary school workshops as well, we use at the end of the workshop puppets. So we have Felicity and Felix, and they'll be discussing things that the children have been open to. So for one of them, we talk about how to deal with conflict and arguments. And then at the end, it's almost like a Jeremy Kyle show between these two puppets. So the children give advice, so then we can actually show, okay, so they have been listening, they're feeding it back. You can see that it's actually working. In secondary schools, we don't use the puppets. There's a performance that I do. We have three actors for it. It's a performance that's broken down to three different parts. It covers quite a few different topics. You've got self-esteem, you've got conflict, you've got depression going on, cyberbullying, online safety as well. You've got all these different characters who've all got quite different complex things happening. And then when the end of the first act happens, you don't know quite what's happened to this very outgoing, sort of what you'd say is a Joker character. And you just hear his mother discover him and scream. So you don't know what's gone on there. So it's quite a shock. And up to that point, it's been all quite light and funny. There's just been things that have been implied. And then we have workshops that will branch off of the different issues that have come up. And in one of those workshops, we say, OK, what do you think happened to that character? And why don't you think he was able to ask for help? And so we go back into the key scenes and the students will give the actors advice on what should have actually happened. And it's then every ending, it's never the same. In some schools, you see a real change because that they've really taken on board what we've done through the workshops. And it's a lot about giving advice as to what help there is out there. In other schools, you can see that there's still quite a big stigma going around about the mental health illness, and they avoid it, and then we delve deeper.
Mm.
And so it's sort of not letting it escape, but letting them discover it for themselves. And yeah, we talk about also many different, it depends on what the teacher wants. Sometimes teachers will message and they'll say, we want to be speaking purely about depression, or we want to be talking about anxiety. Other times it could be homophobia, abuse. All of this is built into this one show that can branch off, which is handy.
Yes.
And then right at the end, the conclusion is what the audience have advised the actors to do. And that's been really, really brilliant to see. Just the audience working together as a team as well. And again, we also offer the talk to the parents there as well, to the older students.
Mm, yeah, absolutely. And it's really interesting there, what you're saying in terms of getting the students involved, because again, to come back to, you know, what we talked about of like appropriateness levels of this kind of education, these are things that the kids are already experiencing. You know, they don't even have to have had experiences of mental illness. They know that the stigma's there. They can see that some people talk about it and some people don't. And so for many of those kids, talking to you guys will be the first time they've had a conversation, they've even mentioned mental illness. And that, you know, as an outsider, is quite scary to imagine. But it's why I'm so grateful that, you know, you're doing that kind of work. And it's interesting what you said about the teachers, that you can see some schools have a better understanding than others. Is that something you struggle with in terms of getting teachers on board?
It can be, especially when I was starting out. It would be that one teacher would contact, they'd be really keen, and they might need to put it by their head teacher or whoever's in charge of the budgets. And sometimes you can really tell, because you can tell even by email, you can see when someone's really enthusiastic. And then when it comes back with a, oh no, or oh, can you knock off £200? And you're already saying, well, I'm not for profit. So, you know, I think it is getting better, but it's still very much there. And I've had emails when the teachers will come back and say, sorry, we just don't have a budget for this. Can you not do it for free? And things like that. And it's upsetting, really, because already we're working at the lowest price we can do it and still be able to eat bread, you know. So, yeah, I think, though, since we've been back, actually, after this summer break, I've had a lot of inquiries. You still get the people who are trying to cut you down on price. But there have also been some people who I think they're getting much more on board.
Good.
I think recently it being in the news a bit more and things like that, and the teachers have been on their summer break and seen it all over. So I do think the change is coming, but they need the money, really. I know that schools will say about a budget, and sometimes they might be telling a bit of a lie, other times not, but I think it needs to be, like you say, definitely on the curriculum, so it's an absolute, well, we need this, so here we are, definite, done.
Exactly. Well, it's about prioritising, and that's something that we've come across a little bit in pushing the petition. People can misunderstand and think that we're trying to push for a mental health subject, like its own separate subject where you have exams about it and coursework and homework. And actually, that's not the case at all. And so many people are coming back then saying, oh, well, the last thing they need is more homework. And I completely agree. But the, you know, the time and the space is there. You know, the teachers are already there. And most people I speak to who have been through, you know, PSHE, even in recent years, there's times where they run out of topics mm-hmm. and they watch a film for a lesson. So, you know, that teacher's still being paid for, that the resources are there. And at the moment, the PSHE Association has optional modules on mm. mental health. So it's not that it's impossible to teach now, but it's about making it compulsory. And I think no doubt by doing that, by normalising it as part of schooling, as part of growing up and education, learning how to keep a healthy mind, no doubt you'll get a lot more interest as well, because they'll realise, oh, actually, this seems to affect a lot of our kids more than we thought. Mm-hmm. Let's see what other resources there are.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm interested in, as well, we talked a little bit off air about this idea that by putting it on the curriculum, you're somehow going to increase mental illness. And we talked a bit about like how there's that parallel with sex education, that when that was made compulsory, it didn't mean that everyone was suddenly having more sex.
Mm-hmm.
It just meant that they were more informed about the choices they were already making.
Yeah, I think because it's out there and everyone does have mental health, let's just try to aid them to know what happens when it might not be so good. What help is out there? What can they do to manage their mental health? If yeah. anything, I think that's aiding students and young people to actually go on. I think there's been many studies and it's obvious that if you're happy, then you're more productive, then you will learn
Absolutely.
More. And therefore, of course, schools, you know, the primary thing is for them to get, you know, those good qualifications to go on to university, to go on and do well in society. But if they're in the right mindset at school to be able to learn everything, then of course there's more chance that more people will go on to do just that.
Absolutely. And is that something you've experienced, any kind of pushback from schools who still think that by having education like this, it's going to create more problems?
I think I've been quite lucky, I suppose, because I'm sort of the front face of the company. I'm not hearing that. I think it's more they'll just think, oh, we're not going to email her back. I think that's all that will happen. So there's a few times when you'll be, they'll have their initial inquiry. We come back with our pricing and things, and then you hear nothing. And then it's almost like, oh, is it not worth then what we're putting a value on there? It's like they're interested in maybe having a quick little dabble in something. But then when you say how much you're charging, then it's, oh, no, it's not worth that. Yeah. I think that's, yeah. That's
absolutely. And in contrast, when now that the Department of Education is looking into this, they've got a plan for education right through primary and secondary school.
Mm-hmm.
That's surely an example of how much is needed.
Mm-hmm.
That actually, I think, if there is any merit to that idea of by talking about this will create problems, it would be that by under-talking about it, by mentioning it once, then kids will be left with a lot of new questions. Whereas actually, if this is something that's in education anyway, they'll have the support there. They can revisit things in later classes. For our campaign, we have these three core aims. The second of which is every child given the ability to access a counsellor through their school. So whether that's a counsellor based at the school, or whether that's just that they partner with a local GP or something where they can be like, okay, we'll get you referred. You can do it through school.
Mm.
I think that's so important. And thirdly, that all the staff have access to education. Whether they're teaching it or not, I think it's important that they can learn about it.
Yes, I would even go as far as to say if they could, then when teachers are training to become teachers, that is covered in the PGCE.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the kind of thing that, so the changes the Department of Education are putting forward would be at the earliest, probably 2020, possibly mm-hmm. 2019. So that's something that logically would then filter back into teacher training over time, which is really positive. But also it's one of these things that will support teachers as well, because I've heard from teachers who have contacted me and said, we really support this. It's so great. I wish I had this in school. However, I didn't. And where I am in my mental health now, I don't know if I could teach a class like that. And that's valid too. And we don't want anyone to be forced into teaching something that's going to negatively affect them. But I think by more of their colleagues having a better understanding, and as you say, ideally that even being in teacher training, then they'll feel more comfortable talking to a colleague and saying, you know what, really support this, but I think this might be a class that I duck out of in the curriculum. and someone else covers me for. And that happens already. There are teachers that don't teach, like we've mentioned, sex ed.
Yeah.
Some schools, even though that's compulsory, bring in GPs or other professionals mm-hmm. to teach that on their behalf.
Yeah.
But the main thing is it's there.
Yes, and I think it's better for a teacher to admit they don't feel comfortable doing it than doing it and being flippant and making comments that could then be really harmful as well.
It's a stigma that we're trying to tackle for everyone. Mm. We don't want the teachers to feel uncomfortable or that they can't speak out either.
Mm.
It's really brilliant to hear about the work you're doing.
What I was thinking earlier, because when I started acting and I ended up in just this little basic TIE thing, but we were being paid and schools were paying for us to go round the schools, and we were working every single day, so there was a big demand. And I was rapping about maths. I mean, it was absolutely awful, but schools were paying money for that, you know, and they, of course, children are taught maths all the time anyway. You know, they don't then need me trying to rap about maths, you know, whereas with mental health, this is something they're not hearing anything. But then I'm, you know, for one day, it may be for that entire year, that's the only thing they're hearing about mental health, you know. And so that's where if teachers are a bit reluctant, it's like, come on now, what negative can come out of talking about it?
Absolutely, and it makes so much sense to us because we're in this world of not pretending it doesn't exist. Mm. And it's interesting what you said earlier about trying to push that away, trying to put what you were feeling, what were real symptoms you were feeling, onto outside things,
yeah.
because heaven forbid they're in your head.
Mm.
So just to round up, now we're unfortunately running a little bit short on time, we'll just finish talking a bit about the petition itself. So obviously I've talked there about the public consultation with the Department of Education, and we'll continue working with them to try and make sure as much is included that needs to be as possible. A big centre of this whole campaign is the petition. As of recording this, we're nearly at 100,000. And that's a big deal because when we get to 100,000 signatures, we can then have this debated in Parliament. Because there has been previous debates, you know, Sure Mind Foundation did incredible work having won last year. However, the difference now is the reforms are going through. There's something tangible for the MPs to support. And we've already got a host of MPs on board with this campaign that we're going to then send and say, you've told us why it's important to you, now go to Parliament and express that. And so I just wanted to round up with two lovely endorsements we've had from different MPs. So first off, we got support from Caroline Lucas, who's currently the co-leader of the Green Party. And that's delightful because that's who I vote for. She said, I am proud to support the campaign by Mental Podcast to get mental health education on the curriculum. The understanding we develop as young people about our own mental health and that of others has lifelong repercussions, not only in the personal relationships we form, but on our careers and prospects and the ability to reach our potential. I really like as well there that she's mentioned relationships, because these reforms include a lot of changes to sex education, trying to make it broader and talk about what is a healthy relationship, not just what is being healthy in your sex life.
It is also linked. Yeah.
Absolutely. And, you know, we've already talked about that. And you said to me off air that you may not have got in those kind of toxic relationships if your self-esteem had been better.
Mm-hmm, precisely.
You know, that they're really linked. And we've also just had endorsement from Rachel Maskell MP. She's with the Labour Party. And she said, one of the greatest challenges facing young people today concerns their mental health. Placing mental health education on the school curriculum is an excellent initiative to support the well-being of children and young adults. So in summary, if you haven't already got the impression, this is something we're so passionate about and we're getting increasingly close to it becoming a reality. I'm so delighted that it's all heading in the right direction. So if you haven't already, listeners, do go ahead and sign and share that petition. We're so close. We may even have 100,000 by the time this comes out, if we're really lucky. And yeah, that's that. So before we finish up then, do you want to talk us through a little bit more about Real Talk Theatre and where people can find it?
Yes. So we do interactive workshops and performances to primary and secondary schools throughout the UK. And if you would like to inquire or just give us a nice call for a chat, give me an email. It's info@realtalktheatre.co.uk. And the website is realtalktheatre.co.uk.
And thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.